Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 5 for Autumn Semester 2018. Lecture 20, delivered on November 1, 2018. The title of this lecture is Pricing Stock.
Tonight, Pricing Stock, Pricing Equity.
Let me get this out of the way here.
And we lock and load and get ready. And so, looking at the stock market, is worthwhile to begin this. We did have a nice, strong up day. And of course, that's as I had told you, we are in a period of strong volatility. Hard down days, strong up days. It's just the way it's going to be for the foreseeable future. When the stock market goes way down, no, that's not the crash. When the stock market goes way up, no, there's going to be no crash. Good times forever ahead. We will have a fall off eventually. It'll be strong. You'll know it when it happens. But for right now, we're having some good days. A market correction, a lot of bargain hunting, buying of stocks. And I will show you that, well, Let me qualify this a little bit here. Tonight I'm going to show you several models for pricing stock. And it's math, but it's just like really easy math. It's nothing to really be strongly worried about. Well, can I do this kind of algebra? It's not even algebra. It's actually arithmetic. But to begin that process, I do want to show you the yield curve information for the day. Whoops. Treasury yield curve data from the U.S. government, and we're going to get the current month's data. Now, as you can, whoa, we got the first day of November coming right here. Now, I want you to notice that the 7-10 year has opened up. We've got an 8 basis point spread, so we're not going to get an inversion on the 7-10. Where the action now seems to be occurring is at the 3-5 year, where you see that the spread has narrowed to 5 basis points. So if we're going to have an inversion, we're now looking at the 3-5 year. But for our purposes now, we have another reason to look at this data. Look at the 1 year, well, actually, the 1 month, 2.21%. That's annualized on a 1 month treasury bill. And then the 1 year, 2.67. And then percent. And then look at the 7 year, 3.06%. Now, there is a theoretical value called R sub F, the risk-free rate. It plays heavily into our ability to calculate discount rates, interest rates. It is a risk-free rate, it's theoretical, and the closest we have in the real world to it, to something that has no risk, a security that has no risk, is a government treasury security. Because, I mean, the government's going to pay you back. There's no risk really involved. The question is, which one of these treasury rates would I want to use? Traditionally, when I've taught this class for many years, some decades, I would always say use the 1 year treasury yield as your approximation, your proxy for the risk-free rate, R sub F, in our models. It was not that many years back, maybe about 5 years ago, I was talking with a couple of financial analysts, and they're pulling out their use of the capital asset pricing model, which uses R-sub-F. They were using a number that I knew wasn't the one-year treasury rate. I said, what number are you using here? And they were both saying, well, you obviously use a seven-year treasury rate. I said, 7 year? Why would you use a 7 year? That would have a maturity premium in it. I mean, it's still a risk-free rate, but there's still maturity risk in anything that's longer term. And I said, we've always used, why are you doing this? They said, well, everyone's using this now. If you're not, then you're behind the times. They said, look, when we need to get a discount rate, R sub S, for some purpose, like present values or capital asset pricing model, we are probably looking at it to use in some kind of a long-term project. Cash flow is going out, you know, years. Why would you use a short-term rate for long-term projects? So that's the logic behind why you're seeing more likely that the 7-year instead of the 1-year treasury bill yield, is going to be what we use in our calculation methods. To begin with, the capital asset pricing model says that the discount rate you would use for cash flows, whatever those cash flows are, cash flow, free cash flow, present value of free cash flows expected, whatever, present value for a lot of things, is going to be the risk-free rate. The rock bottom that all interest rates would have to pay, plus the expected return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate scaled by the beta, the risk of the security. That's the CAPM. It's a simple mathematical formula. And I will tell you that this was developed many years ago, back in the 60s. And it has been challenged over the years. People trying to get a name for themselves said, well, now we can replace the CAPM with this much more complex, realistic form. Turns out, none of them stand the test of time. The CAPM works for finding discount rates. It's simple, it's clean, and you can do it in a couple of seconds. Just get a couple of numbers, and you can get a discount rate to use for net present values or whatever else you wanted to use them for. Okay, now, right here, first things first, this expected return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate is what we call the market premium. Now, technically, you would say it's the market premium over the risk-free. It is the okay. You, sir, have absolutely no desire to take risk. You are the most risk-averse person in the world. That means that you are going to earn no more than the risk-free rate because you don't want to ever take a risk, okay? Now, you, sir, are a cray-cray-crazy SOB. Give me a risk. Okay, let's give you some real risk. Whoa, whoa, whoa. I just want the risk of the market, you know, the global portfolio. Oh, okay, well, that risk, okay. This represents the expected return in the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate represents your reward for taking global market risk instead of no risk. It's essentially just sort of like your extra if you want to invest in the pure market instead of just putting your money into risk-free stuff. Beta is nothing but a scaling factor. A beta of 1 means that you have exactly the risk of you scale to the risk of the market. A beta of 1.5 says that you want 150% of the market premium. A beta of 0.4 says you want only 40% of the market premium. It's just a factor. That's all it is. Now, this guy right here, like I said, the R sub F, you can argue what do you want to use for it, but you just pull it off this chart, whichever, you want a 1 year or a 1 month, if you want a 7 year, just pull it out. It's defensible, but you just want to stay consistent with the, what you use. Now, this guy right here, this expected return to the market portfolio, there are a number of services that actually, you can do find some on Google, that will give you some information services expected return of the market portfolio. What a lot of them do is they do a survey of a select number of finance and economics experts. What do you expect the return to the market portfolio, the global portfolio, to be over the next year? There are a number of services that do this. I am in one of those services. It the one I'm in, it pulls like 70 people, 70 finance people and economics people, and we each give our estimate, and then they take an average of it. And then there are other services that do the same thing with their own select group. Some of them have like 5 experts, 20 experts. There's this one group that's trying to, that's asked me. It's based in Barcelona, oddly enough, and they are trying to assemble 500 experts, thinking that if they get that many, the average would have to be pretty darn close to the best they could do. Now, I don't know how close they are to this, but I'm already under contract. Right now, my estimate of the expected return over the next year to the market portfolio is actually fairly low compared to what others in my group said. If I'm not mistaken, right now, the group I'm in is estimating that the expected return over the next year to a perfect global market portfolio is 8.4%. I think that's awfully high. I mean, yeah, we had a pretty darn good run for years in the stock market, but I don't think we're going to see anything like that over the next year, that return to a big portfolio of, with a beta of 1. But that's just me. I called it at 6.9%, I think, over the next year. Most of that will be in the next few months before the crash happens. But there you go. Anyway, okay, so now, in this case, that would mean that if I take the risk-free rate to be that 2.67%, then the expected the market premium would be 8.40% minus 2.67%. If you think I'm going to do that in my head, you are wrong. Let's do the calculator here. 8.40, see, I'm already screwing up, minus 2.67, whoops, 5.73%. In other words, your additional reward for taking the risk of the global portfolio over what you would get if you took no risk is an extra 5.73%. That's the extra. You, madam, could have worked at Walmart for $20,000 a year, but you took the risk of a university education, which you expect to get you a job at, what's your, $60,000 a year. What's your major?
Marketing.
Okay, a job at $40,000. Oh, no, I'd be mean to you. 60, yeah, 60, yes, 60. $1,000. So your premium for taking risk is $40,000. And that's what that that expected return to the market portfolio minus risk-free rate measures. So in other words, this 5.73% would then be multiplied by the beta to scale it. Okay, if your beta is 1.0, it's the market portfolio. So of course you're going to get exactly the market expected premium. If your beta is higher, 1.5, then you're going to get 150% of that premium of 5.73%. If it's 0.4, you're going to get 0.4 times, 40% of the expected market premium. If you choose a beta of zero, all you're going to get is a risk-free rate, which makes all the sense in the world. Okay, now, why do we have this? Like I said, one thing you can do is calculate the discount rate for a project's future expected cash flows. Now, the problem there is finding the beta for the project. Usually, if you've got a project inside a company and you need to get a beta for that project to do this calculation for the discount rate, you go and find companies that specialize in that kind of project. And you get an average of their betas. In other words, you get what we call comps, C-O-M-P-S, comparables. Okay? But anyway, more generally, we should be able, there are models for being able to price stock, price equity. There's a model for pricing common stock, and there's a model for pricing preferred stock. This is a very easy model to apply. Two things about it. One is, if the company doesn't pay dividends, this model doesn't work. We have to go to some really speculative things for companies that don't pay dividends. It also works best for companies that are older, more stable in their dividend streams, that there's a constant growth rate of the dividends. Many companies, once they start paying a dividend, they try to set it at least soon enough in years so that there's a constant growth of it, 2%, 3%, 5%. And you'll look at the data of older companies, and you'll see that their dividend over a period of years has a fairly constant growth rate. Okay, once we do that, we say, all right, let's look at a company that is old and stable. What we're going to do is find what is more like an intrinsic value of the stock, not the price of the stock from day to day. That is way too volatile, way too subject to the violent emotions of crazy traders and programs just jerking it up and down. What we're finding is more of a long-term price. In other words, this is not something that you should be trading on to make a buck tomorrow. Okay, my model says that the price should be this. The price today is well below that. So I'm going to buy that stock and make a fortune tomorrow. That's not what this is about. This is for long term and buying for a longer term reason. I'm going to start with a company like, first of all, and this is the constant growth dividend model. The price of a share of stock would be its dividend one period forward. Now, that's important to know. If you're given the dividend that has just happened, you have to grow it one period at the growth rate. So, yeah. It's one period forward. In other words, they said, well, the dividend they just paid was 50 cents a share. I don't want to use that. I want to have the dividend that is one period out. Now, most of your problems, I think I've got all the problems. I'm already telling you the dividend one period out, so you don't have to worry about this. But know that you look to say, well, the dividend next year will be, well, that's D1, so you're in business. But if they say the dividend they just paid is, you need to multiply that time by the growth rate to get the dividend next period. But anyway, divided by the discount rate on the stock minus the growth rate, all that in the denominator. So it's D1 over the quantity R sub S minus G. That'll be a price per share as long as you put the dividend in as a per share dividend. This model. Okay. Yeah. Growth dividend. constant growth dividend model. In other words, if I have a stock that has a constant growth dividend, we are saying that the value of that stock, the price of that stock, is actually just the present value of the perpetuity of its dividends forever. In other words, this company's value is all captured in the cash flow of the dividends the investor would get. This is one of the reasons that companies do want to start paying dividends, is so that they show this is truly, you can talk about, well, the stock price will go up, the stock price will go down, but if you're in a buy and hold, all that really matters is the present value of the future expected cash flow from the dividends. You don't plan to sell the stock. You plan, even if you do, that's not how you do okay, here, sir. You are going to make, let's say, $60,000 a year forever. Now, I'm not going to keep you forever. I'm going to sell you next month. Or I'm going to sell you in 3 years, sir. Oh, I'm going to make some money off you. Well, really, in a way, that doesn't matter. Because whoever buys you is going to buy you for the present value of the future expected cash flows at that point in time. And if they sell you in 10 years, then whoever buys you is going to buy you. So in other words, no matter where you sell it, it's still going to be capturing the present value of the future expected cash flows, which would come, in your case, from the money you would make, or in a stock, from the dividends that would happen from there on forward. So realistically, a company is not anything more than its dividend stream that it's going to pay. Because at any point in time, if you sell it, the price you sell it at should still be the present value of the dividends that are going to come after that. Now, be aware, and I'm going to show you this because there's a tricky problem. It's not hard once you see how to do it. But there's this tricky problem in the book where you have some companies that have an unstable dividend for a few years. And then the dividend stabilizes. So that can happen. I'll show you how you... But do appreciate that this finds the value, the price now, but it uses the dividend a period in front. Let me do one here. I'm not going to look at it at first, but I'm going to tell you Kellogg. Kellogg, you know Kellogg, right? Kellogg, have you ever eaten Kellogg cereal? You know, Tony Tiger, they're great! You know, That's Kellogg, this big global company. Yeah, seriously, I mean, don't tell me you don't know Tony Tiger. It's like saying you don't know the Cheetos cheese cheetah. Chester the cheetah, yeah. Chester the Cheetos cheetah. The Cheetos cheetah. Chester the Cheetos cheetah. I mean. Really? Oh, yes, yeah. That, it's like many years ago, their Post was Post Cereals. The company called Post had its own line of cereals. They had Lionel the Lion. And when they brought in this new cereal that was shaped like animals, that it was so awesome because Lionel would start talking about this. And then when he said the name of the cereal, all these animals would stampede over him saying, the one and only cereal that comes in shapes of animals. It just profoundly affected me as a child, that song did. Okay, now, well, I'm going to have to. Let's look at... Yeah. I mean, you know, in your lifetimes, you were children when the Burger King was famous, and that was the creepiest-ass character on earth. Did you ever see the Burger King? Yeah, you remember the one where the guy wakes up and the Burger King is in bed lying next to him? That was, I mean, if that happened to me, I mean, I'd probably just kill myself. Let's look at Kellogg. I'm going to swiftly... Oops. Okay, now. First of all, the beta of Kellogg is 0.40. In other words, this has In a well-diversified portfolio, this has 40% of the volatility of the market. Now, notice that they're giving you the forward dividend, and I need to make a mention of this a little later. But the forward dividend, that is, in other words, the dividend next period. They're giving you what it is going to be the next period. It's $2.24 here. So, in this case, the beta of K is 0.40. The dividend one period out is $2.24 per share. Now, we can apply, we're going to price it, but we'll need the R sub S to do that. That's where the cap M comes in. We can now say, okay, the expected return to Kellogg would be the risk-free rate, and I'm going to use the 2.67% because I'm old school, plus 0.40 times the expected return to the market portfolio, 8.40%, minus the risk-free rate, 2.67%. And that'll give us the discount rate we can use in the growth model for the stock price. Just write this down and then just do it. Don't ask why at first when you're doing the homework problem. Just do this. Okay? You're going to get the discount rate because you need that for this. Okay? Now, I've already done most of this. Well, matter of fact, let me just do it on the calculator so you can see it happening in real time. So we're first of all going to get the R sub K, and in that case, it would be 2.67 plus 0.4 times, open parenthesis, 8.4 minus 2.67. You know what? I am really tired of doing things, screwing up so much on this. Okay, let's try it again. No, 2.67 plus, open parenthesis, 8.4 minus 2.67, close the parentheses, equals. You know what? We're going to do this one more time, okay? I am so bad at I taught arithmetic for almost 10 years at Ohio State. There are so many students who are so screwed up. Oh, really? Is that so? Times, open parenthesis, 8.4 minus 2.67, close the parenthesis, equals, 4.962. So that is the discount rate we're going to use for the cash flow from dividends of Kellogg. So now, okay, now the other thing is, the question would be, what is the growth rate of the dividends of Kellogg? Now, there are several ways you can do this, but what I usually do is I go to the, what's wrong?
I thought R sub S was the discount rate. Is R sub K the discount rate? Or
it's because it's Kellogg. S is for a generic stock. But K, okay, you suddenly become wealthy. And so you want to get monogrammed Kleenex, to linen napkins to blow your nose on. Are you going to get your IAH, I am human, or are you going to get the initials you have?
Honestly, I am human, so way funny.
Oh. You know what my initials are? Alan Brett Kring, ABC. My parents thought they were really, they weren't. They were from the hills, and that was their idea of intellectualism. But... Yes, the K is the Kellogg. S is generic stock. Okay, now. Anyway, to get the growth rate of the dividends, One thing you can do is go into the company's 10-Ks and look at where they report their dividends over the last, say, 5 years, and you just get the average growth rate. One way you can do it is take the last year's dividends you see minus the over the first year's and raise it to the one over the number of years. Yeah. Growth rate. That's the growth rate. And right now, what I'm trying to think about is what would be the growth rate of Kellogg's dividends. Best one that I'm going to give you what I've seen from what I was looking at. The growth rate of Kellogg's dividends, I'm going to call it about 2% a year. About 2% growth rate. Now, with an old, stable company, it's not going to be a spectacular growth rate. But there is going to be a growth rate. That's something I said earlier in the course. When I was doing consulting, I'd have companies, you know, after they'd been in business for a couple of years, they'd say, you know, is it time for us to start paying a dividend? And I would caution them about that, because once you start paying a dividend, the market will expect you to keep paying it. If you pay a dividend and then you stop, the market's going to spank you hard. The other thing the market wants is to see a constant growth rate of the dividend. So once you start paying, and I explained this to some of my clients, look, once you start paying a dividend, you have to keep paying it. And you have to be strong enough that within a period of maybe a few years, you stabilize the growth rate of that dividend. So yeah, the first year you might pay a 40-cent dividend. Then the next year you might pay a 50-cent. Dividend. But after a couple of years, you better establish that every year the growth of that dividend is going to be a specific percentage of what it was the next year. So in other words, a growth rate of 5%, a growth rate of 2%. Don't get excited and make a growth rate that is extraordinary, because the market's going to know you can't sustain that. And it's going to punish you for being stupid and trying to set your goals too high on that. So anyway, we're now in a position where we can give a forecast of the long-term intrinsic value as of now of Kellogg. The price of Kellogg should be about, intrinsic value-wise, the forward dividend, that's 1 year out, of $2.24 a share, divided by the discount rate, 0.0492, minus the 2% growth rate. Now, be careful when you do this on a calculator. Put it in parentheses, okay? Yeah.
How did you find the 2%?
That's what I said, is I looked at their financials, and it appears that it's stable around a 2% per year growth rate of the dividend right now. Now, I might change this value if it looks like Kroger or Kellogg has increased its growth rate, or if it decreases the growth rate, I will recalculate. But right now, it seems that it's pretty stable around that value. So now we're going to roll and see what the price is that we get. We would do $2.24 divided by, open parenthesis, 0.0492, minus 0.02, close the parenthesis, equals. Did I screw that up? Okay, let's try it again. I talk and I do this, and you see it happens every time. 2. Divided by, open parenthesis, 0.04962. Minus 0.02, close a parenthesis, equals 75.62 a share. Did I get it that time? 75.62 a share. Yes. Now, let's look at the price of the company's Kellogg's right now. Okay. That's what I'm about to talk about. My calculation says that the long-term intrinsic value right now. Now, that sounds kind of odd. I'm saying the long-term intrinsic value right now is $75.62 a share, against the backdrop that the stock's price closed at $64 a share today. In other words, and actually, if you look at the chart, Kellogg has gotten the crap smacked out of it the last couple of days. Do you see this? Look at that. Boom, like that. Notice that before that drop-off, look at that thing. Look at that. That's a cliff. Yeah. Kellogg gave disappointing earnings. Okay? And markets are pure animal. A market doesn't have intellectualism about it. It doesn't have reasoning. It reacts quickly and violently to news like this. So when Kellogg says we had earnings that did not meet expectations, well, then the market is just going to react and knock that down. Also, I had talked about this before, when markets have very serious downturns, everything is dragged down at the same time. The good and the bad are all killed in the tsunami. But ultimately, and you heard me talk about this, bargain hunters will come in and buy up the stock that was taken down inappropriately, ultimately, once the storms are over. So what it looks to me like is that if you were to look at just a few days ago, Kellogg was actually close to its long-term intrinsic value. But again, like I said, day-to-day is definitely not going to measure long-term intrinsic value. It's going to measure market value. Go. I love it when you talk like that, yes. In a well-diversified portfolio.
Buy this one.
Here's the thing, and that's the next thing I was going to say. This is, okay, if you wanted to form a portfolio and your target beta was low, like a 0.35, 0.5, 0.4, this would definitely be a stock for a long-term buy-and-hold portfolio. It's undervalued on a long-term basis. No, you're not going to make a fortune tomorrow because suddenly the stock price, everyone's going to say, oh, wow, we got to buy this and drive it to its long-term intrinsic value. That ain't going to happen. But over a long period of time, it will happen. There's an analogy to this in economics. When I would teach economics courses, and I taught them for many years, there's something that is called the long-term minimum efficient scale of operations. It's where the long-term average cost curve bottoms out. It's the output level where long-term average cost curve bottoms out. It is formed by the short-term average cost curves. I don't know, and I should actually ask you, if they ever showed you this in class, quantity against cost. A company's cost curves look like this as its scale of production increases. Were you taught this in your economics class, that at any given time there's a marginal cost curve that is at the bottom of the average cost curves? Okay, if you look at a company's cost curves over a long period of time, there's an envelope that is formed by its short-term average cost curves. This is called the long-run LRAC, long-run average cost curve. Interestingly, the company will actually never see the long-run average cost curve. They will never see the minimum long-term efficient scale of operations. They'll never see it. All they'll ever see are these bottoming out points on a short-term cost curve. And so the company will continue to grow and grow and grow way past the point where it has bottomed out its average cost per unit of production. We'll see massive corporations that are insanely inefficient because they should have stopped back here where their costs were at their minimum. But they'll never see it. They'll just keep growing because they're animals. A corporate thinking pattern has to be short term. It can't be long term. We can say we look for the long term in our decision making. No, you don't. That's not how you do it. But if you will look at an industry over many years, decades, you will see that ultimately the minimum average output per firm is at this. Because the inefficient firms will ultimately die or they'll break up over a long period of time. This is the same thing that happens in a portfolio. The short-term thinking of a trader has nothing to do with long-term intrinsic value. That's why you as an investor are responsible for looking at long-term. Okay, Kellogg right now is on a downstroke. It's getting the crap smacked out of it. But that is not what's going to happen in the long run. In the long run, this is, at least in my judgment, this is a buy. Let me ask you something really, this is kind of a personal question, but I always like to apologize when I get really personal with people. Okay, not with you. Oh, yes, with you. Madam, are you going to stop eating cereal? Ever? No. You? No. Madam, are you going to ever give up cereal? I have to have cornflakes. Sometimes I go a little overboard and I get those cinnamon crispy thingies. And then there's that once in a while with Rice Krispies because I like to hear that snap, crackle, pop, Rice Krispies. Kellogg's best to you. Okay. Anyway, the point here, is Kellogg going to die? Is it going to go away? Is its stock price going to go down in the long run? No, because it is a cereal company and the world will eat cereal forever. You see, think about it in the long run. The market is going to react on the day's trading and the information, their earnings weren't what they said they'd be, and so we're going to spank the company. There was a time, sir, when you were a young man and when your mom used to paddle your ass, but you know that in the long run she was going to love you and be proud of you, okay? You're like, what the hell, man? Leave me alone. No, seriously, though. You know that even when your dad said, you dumbass, get out. You know that in the long run there'd be a loving, huggy reunion. Oh, God, I love you and I love you too. And that's when your dad has a heart attack and kicks off. That's what's going to happen to me when my daughter finally says, yes, I understood what you were all about. You were a creep. And then I thank her and I die. You see, that's the point that I'm trying to get at. Look, day to day, yeah, if you want to be a day trader and pay massive, stupid commissions to jerk in and out of stocks, go for it. But if you're a long-term player that's looking at your end-of-life story, well, it's probably going to be more like this, okay? Buy for that intrinsic value. And in this case, I would say that intrinsic value indicates that this is an undervalued stock. Put it into your portfolio. It's a low beta if that's what you want. If you're a high-risk trader player, this would not be appropriate. You should be looking at higher-risk stocks. Okay, now, a couple of things. First of all, what happens if a company doesn't pay dividends? Well, essentially, you're kind of in a bad situation there because you're going to basically have to project free cash flow for a number of years out by some one method or another. You're going to get the last couple of years free cash flow. Look at the average growth rate of that free cash flow. And then from there, project it maybe 10 years out and find the present value of it. And then divide by the number of shares to get the price per share. That's basically about all you could do, is just get sort of get a growth rate of free cash flow, stream it out like 10, 20 years, and then find the net present value of that future expected free cash flow and divide it by the number of shares. That'd give you a sort of an estimate. Really speculative to do that. Really speculative. I do want to bring up something important here. Ex-dividend. You see this thing, ex-dividend date? Okay, every year the board of directors, in its meeting, in a meeting, it determines what will be the dividend that is paid next. It will also, at that meeting, determine the of record date. So in other words, in this case, if you are a stockholder of record as of 11:30, November 30th, you will get the dividend that is paid. If you buy it after that date, you will not get that dividend. Now, what this means is that, okay, stock prices have all kinds of noise, up and down and up and down. However, as the ex-dividend date approaches, the stock price will, among all the other factors, rise by $2.24. And then on the day after X, boom, it will drop off that $2.24. Because if you bought this stock, let's say on November the 29th, you're going to get $2.24 free the next day. Well, you won't get it the next day. But if you, so in other words, as you see the ex-dividend date, the date of record approaching, you will see the stock price being bid up because there's a $2.24 piece of candy in it that you'll get. And then the day after, like that, it just drops off because you don't get that candy anymore. So all stocks that pay dividends have that cyclical flow. Now, you probably can't see it because there's so much noise in the stock price up and down. But it's there going up and down as the ex-dividend dates approach, leave. It's just something to mention here that it's like that. Now, I want to show you something here. I'm going to write a problem here. Now, at first, it looks like this problem's pretty complicated, but it's actually really easy. You can even do this one in Excel, although I probably won't because it's a little too easy. JNC will next year pay a 40-cent per share dividend and a year later it will pay a 50-cent per share dividend. After that, the dividend will grow at a constant rate of 2.5% per year. What is the current price of JNC Common? Assume a discount rate of, well, I don't know, 7.5%. Okay. Draw a timeline. draw a timeline. Year zero. We're assuming that it hasn't paid or already just paid its current dividend. Year one, year two, year three, four, five, etc. forever. Now, year one, it's going to pay a 40-cent per share dividend. At year two, it's going to pay a 50-cent per share dividend. And I'm drawing this on the timeline here. Now, after that, the dividend will grow at a constant rate of 2.5% per year. As a matter of fact, let's make this a little bit more interesting. Well, no, that'll be fine. So in other words, right here, the dividend here would be 50 cents per share times 1 plus 0.025, the dividend growth, D1. Notice that if I use the dividend growth model right here, I will find its price right here. In other words, this 50 cents per share times 1 plus 0.025 divided by 0.075 minus 0.025, that is the price of the stock right here at period two. In other words, this finds a present value one period before your D1. You have to think about that for a minute. But when you calculate that, you're finding the price one period before the dividend that you used. So in this case, and I'm going to erase this here in a second, I'm going to say, well, what would a 50 cent per share dividend grown one year at 2.5% B, it'd be 51.25. So in other words, this dividend right here, if it is 2.5% more than the 50 cents, is 51.25 cents. And I don't have to worry about any of that because the formula, is all it needs is D1. And so if I have year three is 51.25, then the price at year two would be 51.25 cents over 0.075 minus 0.025 by the dividend growth model. But I also get a 50 cent dividend there too. So in other words, the price of JNC Common right now should be 40 cents discounted back one period at 7.5% plus 50 cents plus 0.5125 over 0.075 minus 0.025 discounted back two periods. That would have to be its price. Now, it looks complicated, but if you break it down, basically all you're doing is saying, okay, the dividend one period out is going to be 40 cents. I discount that back. Plus, I'm going to get a 50-cent dividend in 2 years, so I discount that back. But I also know that from there, the dividend will grow by this amount that I can use to calculate the price of the stock here. It takes a while to do it, but follow what I'm doing right here. And just when you see this problem in the problems for this chapter, just put the numbers that you see there where I put the numbers on the timeline here. And then it will fall into place. Again, this is one of those, don't think too much about what the heck you're doing, at least at first. If I crank this out, well, first of all, let me find out what that number is there. 51.5125 divided by, open parenthesis, 0.075, oops, 0.075 minus 0.025, close the parenthesis, equals. That 0.05125 divided by 0.075 minus 0.025 is actually $10.25. So in other words, X dividend in year two, if I sold the stock right after the dividend was paid, I would sell the stock for $10.25, plus I would have the 50 cent I had just gotten in the dividend. So the total value of the stock right here at year two is actually $10.75. And I'll discount that back two periods. $0.50. So in other words, the present value of the 50 cents and the 10.25, two periods out, discounting back at 1.075 raised to the negative 2 power plus the 40 cents discounted back one period times 1.075 to the negative first power . The current price of the stock should be at the intrinsic value should be $9.67. Per share. That's what it should be. Like I said, just if you've got this in your notes, just take the numbers that are given to you in the problem and replace them with what I've just shown you, and you'll get your answer. Now, there's one variation on this that's important to bring up. Preferred stock has a dividend, and it stays the same dividend forever. So there's no growth in it. So the special example, the price of preferred stock is nothing but the permanent dividend D divided by the current discount rate on that preferred stock. That's all it is. It's the simplest formula in the world. Simplest formula in the world. Let me give you one. DVA preferred, cumulative preferred, no, I'm sorry, DVA, let's say 2% cumulative preferred. Par value, $40 per share. It's all you need to know to get started. This will pay 2% of $40, which is 80 cents, per year forever. This is what it'll pay. Okay, so Now, suppose that the market says, you should be paying us 2.5% based on the risk of this. Or the market says, you should be paying only 1.5%. Or the market says you should be paying 2%. Let's look at it. Suppose that the market says that the discount rate should be 1.5%. So in this case, we'd have 80 cent a share dividend forever divided by the market cap of 0.015. If I did that, I would find that the price is what? 50? Let me do that. I'm not even going to try that in my head. 80 cents divided by 0.015, $53.33. Suppose that the market said, so in other words, in this case, because the dividend is paying more than the market says it needs to, this stock will sell at a premium to its par value. It's like a bond that way. Now watch what happens if the market says it should be paying a better dividend than it is. So in this case, it'd be 0.80 divided by 0.025. And in this case, it should come out to be $32, I think. 0.8 divided by 0.025. Yep, $32. So in other words, if the dividend isn't as much as the market says it should be, the preferred stock sells at a discount to par, just like a bond. That's why preferred stock is equity. It has residual claim and all that, but it has this weird behavior like a bond. Now suppose that the market says it should pay 2%, and that's what it's paying. Well, if you do that, it comes out to be exactly $40. It sells at par because the market says it's paying exactly what it should. Oddly enough. There's a story behind this. First of all, preferred stock is not as popular as it used to be, but it's still out there. And it would certainly be something that would be good in a fixed income portfolio. Interestingly enough, though, the model itself has incredible usage. So, you, madam, have become a wealthy old woman in your old age. I mean, you are really rich, and you want to endow a professor's chair here at Illinois State University. In fact, you want this to be the Professor Alan Kring Chair of Finance, Economics, and Cheeseburgers. Indeed. You're looking at me like, yeah, right, sure that's going to happen. Okay, so the thing, though, is that we've calculated. You want to pay the professor, let's say, $250,000 a year, and you want to have an additional $300,000 for some graduate assistance and for equipment for this endowed chair. So you want this amount of money you endow to provide a cash flow of $550,000 a year forever. This model will do it for you. All you would have to do in this case is say, okay, $550,000 a year, and we're going to put this into very safe, long-term, they'll pay the same forever. That would be preferred stock. We'll find one that with a cap of 3%. In other words, if preferred stock pays 3% dividend forever, and then we calculate how much you have to endow, what the present value is for this to happen. So we'll do 0.0 divided by 0.03. So we're going to say 550,000 divided by 0.03. You have to put in $18,333,000, and you will have established a forever endowment. That's how we do it. Wealthy people come to us, we want to do this endowment. We say, okay, if you want to provide that much money every year forever, here's what you would have to pay. Here's what you would have to donate to the university to accomplish it. Now, obviously, with one this big, that's going to be a fairly rare thing. But we have people who come and say, we want to establish a scholarship that makes, let's say, 4 scholarship payments of $5,000 a year, and we want these scholarships to be issued every year for forever. Well, we tell them, we use that model right there. That's how we do what we do. You would have to endow us with a certain amount of money, let's say $20,000 a year, divided by some very low interest rate that would be what you would earn on like a preferred stock forever. Now, the interesting part, and this is where you come in, what happens? Okay. You might have heard that there's a pension fund crisis here in Illinois. There's way too little money to pay the benefits that we have promised state employees, like me. As I calculate it now, I will be able to afford very cheap cat food once a week if I retire in 20 years. But here's what happened. They promised in the agreements with employees for their annuities, for their retirement, that they would get a specific amount of money every year. That would be their annuity. Now, the problem was that meant that they had to have a specific amount of money in, let's say, my account at my projected age of retirement. And then that would create a cash flow every year after that, if there was a certain amount of money in there. The assumption was that if I put money in every year for, let's say, 40 years, it would earn 8%. And so that would grow to be that amount of money I would have that I could then draw every year after that. The problem with it was that by the rules of the safety of the investments, these investments could earn no more than about 3%. So in other words, they were projecting that I would have this certain amount of money at retirement based upon a growth rate of 8%, which meant that I didn't have to put in nearly as much money as I would under the situation which actually existed, where they could put it in only, they could invest only at 3%. Think about it this way. If this is a 0.08 down here, this endowment does not need to be nearly as large to achieve this number here. Let me say that again. If this number down here is larger, then to get this amount of money every year, this number doesn't have to be as big. The problem was that they were using a 0.08 to project what I would need to have in at the day of retirement, when in fact they could not invest it at 0.08, they were investing at 0.03. So they should have had probably 2.5 to 3 times as much money. Here's the upshot of it. Yes, Illinois screwed it up this way. Most states in their public employees screwed it up. But here's the secret for you guys. Almost every pension plan in the United States, public or private, screwed it up this way. In about 10 years, there's going to be this huge, no one ever saw this coming. All of these private pension plans companies had for their employees are going to be bankrupt. And that means that what will happen to you is that they will try to bleed you to make up the difference with making you pay more into your retirement funds to try to pay for people like me who are going to be old. Don't worry about me. I'll be so old, all I can do is bitch at you. But the problem is that what it means for you, you'll probably have to work until you're like, okay, 70? I would go for three numbers.